Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a program brought to you by the Pacifica Network every week at this time and devoted, as we always are, to the economic events that are shaping our lives, whether they be local, national, or international, whether they affect our jobs, our incomes, our debts, whatever. It's about the economy and how we interact in and with it. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns for a variety of outlets, including especially truthout.org. That's a remarkable independent source of news and analysis that I think is well worth your checking out at truthout.org. If you are interested in pursuing the kinds of analysis you hear on this program, please go to our websites. That's what they're for. They collect there the materials I write, the research we do, the interviews and stories and classes I present. It's all there, 24/7, available at no charge. One website that collects all of my work is rdwolff.com. rdwolff.com. And the other website, which is focusing more on our project of democratizing the economy, is called democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites are available. Through either of them, you can also sign up for our free regular newsletters. They bring you the information rather than you having to go to the website to find it. If you're interested, go to the website, sign up for the free newsletter, and we will be in touch with you on a regular basis. I need also to remind you that all of this costs money, and both websites have donate buttons where, if you like this program and if you like what we're doing, you can help us pay the costs of providing it. And finally, both websites allow you to communicate to me and to those of us who prepare each program. We read everything you send, comments, criticisms, and questions. We select a few, only a few of the many we get, to respond to in these programs, but all of your comments are used to shape what we do. So let's jump right in to the economic update for this week. The first one comes from Forbes magazine. I want to thank them, and to their writer, Darren Blomquist. He covers a remarkable event that is a sign of how our economy is working, or isn't, depending on your point of view. Here's what's going on in the foreclosed home situation. Let's remind ourselves what that's all about. When people think the economy is doing well, when they hope to participate in the American dream, when they're led to believe that their jobs, if they work hard, will get better, that their income, if they work hard, will rise, they will often be invited or cajoled or maneuvered into buying a home, a condo, a co-op, a home, a house, in the hope that they can provide for themselves, their children, the kind of life they were led to believe hard work would procure. But then, of course, unemployment hits, because that's the way a capitalist economy works every few years. And sometimes it's really bad, as it has been since 2007. And people who had bought a home and borrowed to do it lost their job, most of the time through no fault of their own, because the economy isn't working. But if they lose their job, they can't maintain their mortgage payments, the payment on the debt they took out to buy the home. And then the lender, usually a bank, comes to them and says, if you don't pay up in the next month or two, we're going to do what we have the right to do as the lender who provided you with the money to buy the home. We're going to end the deal, and you're going to be thrown out of your home. And we're going to take the home because that's the collateral you pledged for the loan that allowed you to buy the home. Now, you may have wondered, we've had millions of people in America over the last 5 years, thrown out of their homes by this foreclosure proceeding that the lenders took against them. They've lost their homes. The lenders take the homes. But the lenders are banks. They're not in the home business. What they want is to get rid of that house, either because it's a hot potato losing value, because the houses around it are in trouble, because so many people are unemployed, so they want to get rid of it before it loses any more value, or they're just interested in recovering as much of their loan as possible, and they want to sell the house. Who do they sell the house to? You might have thought it was to another family that didn't suffer unemployment and could now buy a home. That happens sometimes. But what I want to talk to you about is a whole new development. There are rich investors in the United States, and indeed around the world, who pool their money with the help of big Wall Street enterprising firms, investment banks, and their affiliates. These rich people pool their money and see an opportunity. They jump into the housing market, buying up the foreclosed homes because they know the banks want to sell them in a hurry and will make an attractive low price. In other words, rich people, through their investment opportunities, are buying up the homes taken away from middle and lower income Americans. And you know what they're doing? They're converting them into rental properties. They have huge tracts of houses. It's running at 500,000 housing units per year right now, and particularly heavily in states like Florida, California, and Nevada, heavily hit by the foreclosure crisis. But what the bottom line is, we live in an economy going through difficulty. So the people in the most difficulty, suffering from unemployment, lose their homes, become homeless, have to become renters. And who do they pay rent to? The wealthy people who could take advantage of the situation by buying their houses on the cheap. It's a conversion of houses from the property of middle and poor people into the property of the rich. That's how our economic system works. The second update has to do with this phenomena spreading across America of arming the public. In particular, laws have been passed, actually 7 states out of the 50, now permit teachers and administrators in schools to carry guns in the schools. 3 of these measures took effect last week in the states of Kansas, South Dakota, and Tennessee. And here's something that came across my desk that I found fascinating. States that are allowing their schools' personnel to carry guns have a little problem they hadn't foreseen. The insurance companies, who they pay premiums to cover themselves, the schools do, and the school systems, in the event of violence happening or damage or injury happening in the schools, which the schools have to compensate the victims for, and they carry an insurance policy. Well, the people in favor of arming teachers and administrators in schools have always used the argument, it will make everything safer. It will prevent violence. It will dissuade the wayward student or outsider who has malice in his or her mind from coming into the school. In other words, the argument was, let us arm teachers and administrators to get greater safety. Here come the insurance companies and they say, oh, no, no, no. That might be good public relations to try to convince gullible people to allow guns in school, but we're going to have to pay the freight if something goes wrong. And we think, the insurance companies say, that if you bring schools into the world of guns by allowing teachers and administrators, you don't make it more safe, you make it less safe. And the insurance companies have acted. In many cases, they've raised the insurance rates on the schools. In other cases, they've cut back the amount of coverage they'll write at all. They've canceled the policy. And in no case that I know of, and I've looked, did an insurance company lower its rates. So they don't believe the place has become safer. The insurance companies clearly believe that arming teachers and administrators is the route to greater violence and injury, not the other way around. Congress these days, in our third update, is dealing with a question of lowering the corporate tax rate in this country. For those of you that pay attention, this is astonishing. The corporate tax rate has been lowered drastically over the last 30 or 40 years, far more than the tax rate on individuals. Corporations have done real well. Undeterred, the Congress that the corporations fund so generously is now planning to pay back. And here's the argument. The corporate legal rate in the United States on corporations is 35%. As countries go, that's rather high. That's true. And so the Congress is saying, let's lower it. What is left out of this conversation is the following. While the legal rate is 35%, there are oodles and oodles and oodles of tax loopholes specifically written into the laws under the pressure of these corporations to give them a break. And we now have a wonderful study by the GAO, that's an office of the United States government, reported on by the Bloomberg Economic News Service on the 2nd of July, to be specific, in which the GAO did a study requested by the Congress. And here's what they studied. They took all the corporations that made money in the year 2010, and they asked about those corporations, what did you actually pay? Not the 35% you're legally supposed to, but what you are legally allowed to use in the way of loopholes. Tell us what, in the end, was the percentage you actually paid. Here's what the GAO, Government Accounting Office, an official branch of the United States government, reported, as carried by the Bloomberg service. In 2010, the effective rate of corporations earning profits that year and having to pay taxes on those profits was, you ready, 12.6%. Nowhere near the 35% being pointed to by conservatives as something that has to come down. And what was it in 2009, the year before? 13%. And what was it in 2008, the year before? 15.3%. In other words, for the last 3 years that we have records for, the actual rate by corporations is around a third of what the 35% is legally. They don't need more tax cuts. Everybody else does. My next update is a charmer. It has to do with the pay of chief executive officers of major companies. In fact, the New York Times, on June 30th of this year, carried a list of CEO payments for 200 companies doing more than $1 billion worth of business. So they're the big giants of our economic system. And I'd like to just select a few to show you how you, each of you watching, listening to this program, makes a contribution, sooner or later, to the kind of pay these folks get. So let's begin. Near the top, CBS, the television station. Its chief executive, Leslie Moonves, took in, and this is for the year 2012, took in $60,253,000 in a year. Now let me make clear what this is. This is more than $1 million a week, a lot more. So whereas you may occasionally buy a lottery ticket, enjoying the fantasy, which most of us will never realize, of earning a million or two or three or four, Mr. Moonves doesn't worry like we do about the $4 he might have shelled out for a lottery ticket and winning $1 million. It would bore him. Because every week, 52 weeks of the year, whether he's working or on vacation, more than $1 million comes into him, and he doesn't have to buy any tickets at all. Next, Walt Disney. I won't embarrass anyone by asking whether you've shelled out for a Mickey Mouse doll or a Disney cartoon or a visit to the Disney parks. But the chief executive there, Robert Iger, he took home $37 million. Now, that's more than $500,000 a week. Isn't he doing wonderfully? Aren't we pleased for Mr. Iger? The head of eBay, John Donahoe, $29 million. The head of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, $28 million. Every week, more than $500,000, $500,000 a week. So every time you buy a latte, you're helping Mr. Schultz take home that kind of money. ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, $27 million a year. Time Warner, Jeffrey Bukes, $26 million a year. And so it goes. It may be a recession. It may be hard times. But remember, the people for whom it's hard times are paying the bills that roll this kind of money into people, all of whom are already very, very wealthy. That's how this system works. A couple of more updates before we turn to our bigger conversations. Folks have been asking me, are corporations doing the kinds of thing they ought to be doing to help us get out of this crisis we've been in now for 5.5 years? Began in the December of 2007, and here we are, halfway through 2013. And the short answer is no, corporations are not doing what they need. And here's one measure. And I take this from the Quartz website, QZ.com, which I urge you to take a look at. And they did a wonderful piece of research measuring how much cash on hand corporations other than banks, non-financial corporations, how have they been dealing with the cash that comes into them? Have they turned around and invested it, as they keep telling us they're doing? You know, they like to be called job creators. Well, have they been creating jobs with the money they've earned, the extra money they've earned because wages are down, the extra money they've earned because they've cut benefits? Have they been creating jobs? The answer is not particularly. And here's one way to measure it. How much cash are they holding? Well, it's gone up pretty steadily since 2008. And it reached a record in the first quarter of 2013. Almost $1.3 trillion compared to barely $800 billion back in 2008. It's a straight line. Corporations are taking all the money that they've earned. They don't have much confidence in this economy. They look around. They see it as it is. Not as the political leaders would like us to believe. They don't see recovery, and they're holding on to their cash. And here's the irony. If corporations don't invest, if they hold on to this cash as we see them doing, then they are not helping us get out of the recession. They are actually making a decision that keeps us from getting out of the recession. And we permit this tiny collection of mega corporations to accumulate this kind of money, keep us all in recession, and nobody says boo. Finally, a story about Australia that I think is also a sign of how these capitalist economies work. My attention was drawn to a company called Cash Converters. Pawnbrokers is what they are. And they're the fastest growing Australian retailer in the last year, more than any other store in that country, suffering an economic downturn like so many other countries. The fastest growing retailer is the pawnbroker, the person you turn to when your situation is so dire you have to sell your TV or your watch or your electrical equipment. I wish I had numbers about this in other countries, but the Australians keep these records, and here's a sign of the times if ever we needed one. Okay, let's turn now to the first of our two major discussions for today, on Economic Update. And I want, in this case, to focus, if I may, on the so-called recovery. We're supposed to believe that the economy is recovering. Well, I understand why the political leaders want us to believe that, so we don't vote them out in anger that our economy is in trouble. And I can imagine a few hangers-on in the media believing the politicians, and maybe a bunch of folks in the real world who want so badly, as we all do, to think the economy is getting better. I can see it, but it isn't true. And last week, the International Monetary Fund, one of the major international economic organizations in the world, whose job it is to look at the world economy and see how it's going, updated its review of where we are. And its results are what I want to report and discuss with you. Because they're straightforward, they're not sugar-coated, and they have nothing to do with people trying to look through rose-colored glasses for fear of what they otherwise might see. Here's what the IMF reported. Growth, economic growth, which wasn't good to begin with at the beginning of 2013, has been slowing. That's right. It's getting worse, not better. We are not recovering. We're slipping. And in particular, the IMF singles out emerging economies, smaller but important economies that had been, in a way, carrying the economic system of the world at a time when the United States and Europe over the last few years have been in real trouble, and Japan as well. I'm thinking here particularly of the following, mentioned by the IMF: China, India, Russia, Brazil, Mexico, South Africa. All of these are countries that were doing well because they cashed in on China's growth, to be blunt. They produced things that the Chinese wanted to buy, and the Chinese economy has been growing quickly, 6, 7, 8% at a time when Western economies were hardly growing at all. So the Chinese kept growing, and they bought more and more stuff from these other countries, and that was carrying the world economy, or at least making the downturn less awful than it might have been. But the Chinese economy is now slowing too, so they can't be the engine of growth at a time when the world needs it. And not only that, more and more producers in North America, Europe, and Japan are moving to those countries to take advantage of the lower wages. They've been doing that for years, and that too has kept those countries growing when the rest of the world didn't. The country, the old centers of capitalism that businesses were leaving, were in trouble. And the new places had some boost. But that's now running out of gas because big corporations don't want to invest anywhere anymore. So guess what? Those countries, China, India, but now let me mention some more, Turkey, Brazil, even Egypt, they had been booming for a while, even when Europe and North America and Japan were in trouble, and they thought they were in for the economic growth that had eluded them for centuries, and that they were going to cash in on the economic growth that had blessed the United States, Europe, and Japan for centuries. But they were wrong. What they were welcoming in those countries was a capitalism that's very unstable, that has a period of growth, but is now suffering a severe 5.5-year decline. So the hopes, the dreams, the expectations, the promises of what a booming capitalism would bring to these countries is now showing no legs, doesn't last, brings downturn. And the people and governments of Turkey, Brazil, and other countries are angry, are upset, feel betrayed, and they're in the streets about it. No big surprise, no mystery. They are angry that the promise of capitalism, which they welcomed with open arms, turns out to have been a false promise. The IMF goes further. It says Europe is in trouble and not coming out of its crisis. No recovery there at all. And as if to underscore the point, the credit agency Standard & Poor's, just this last week downgraded the national debt of Italy, the third largest economy in Europe, to barely above junk status. That is a major blow to the Italian government's hopes for doing something to take that troubled economy out of the doldrums. And finally, last but not least, the IMF cut the prognosis for American growth, another 0.2% of a percentage point. That's right. American growth is declining. We're not even halfway back to the unemployment rate we had before this crisis hit. That was below 5%. We're over 7.5% still. Are we coming out of that by a growth spurt? No, says the IMF. We're declining. And they point specifically to the government's policies pushed by Republicans and Democratic conservatives alike. Austerity, raising taxes, cutting government spending, the sequester, the rise in the payroll tax we've had this year, all of that. They're crystal clear where the problem lies. Crystal clear where the problem lies with government policy. So here we have it. A recovery? Stop. Don't be misled. Don't be fooled. And don't make your own personal economic decisions on the assumption that we're in an economic recovery. We might wish it, and the politicians worry about it because they need to get reelected. But make no mistake, when it comes to analyzing the actuality, no recovery for the vast majority. Even the few who've made a recovery because they got bailed out by the government or they hold significant amounts of shares of stock, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, so the rise in the stock market has helped them. That tiny minority of Americans who have significant amounts of stock, they had a recovery, but they now risk losing what they had, because if you keep the mass of people in the unrecovered condition of crisis that we've kept the American people in, then sooner or later, those at the top rediscover their ultimate dependence on those, the majority at the bottom, and we face another major downturn. And more economists are worried about that coming soon. We're now going to take our mid-program break, as we often do. In some cases, you hear some music. In other cases, your stations will make announcements. But please know we'll be back in a very short time to resume economic update. This is Richard Wolff reminding you that before we take the break, this might be a time for you to take a look at the websites that we maintain for you to follow any of the items we discuss here if you're interested. Once again, they are rdwolff.com with two F's and democracyatwork.info. Both of them are available to you. Both of them allow you to sign up for our regular free newsletters. And both of them have donate buttons where we ask for and appreciate in advance whatever you can do to help cover the costs. We'll be right back.
A fools, how fools, when do we know Iran is too? Imi, a fools, how fools, when do we know Iran is too? I will take the train, leave the sun for the rain, and come downtown, town, town, and come downtown, town, town. I'll spend money and time. Child, I will come downtown to you now, 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 downtown to you now, now, now. He makes me a fool for fools. When do we know it? I'm too. run for the rain and come downtown, town, town, and come downtown, town, town. I'll spend money and time, lose friends and cry. More than a motherless child, I will come downtown to you now, now.
Okay, we are back. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. And we're in that phase of our program where we talk about major issues that need a bit more time and analysis to cover properly, to make you aware as best I can of what the issues are and what's at stake in the economic events of our lives. So I'm going to talk again, as I have before, because I have to, about austerity, about the policy of the government in Britain, in France, in Germany, in most countries of the world, including the United States, because it keeps being discussed in ways that are systematic misinformation. And I'm being as polite as I know how in characterizing what is being said and implied and suggested. What is an austerity economic policy? It is a policy followed by a government in a time of economic crisis, when large numbers of people are unemployed, when large portions of our capacity to produce are sitting idle, when a vast amount of the wealth we're capable of producing and that we need as an economic system is not being produced, even though the people want jobs and the tools and equipment they need to work with and raw materials are all available. It is a moment of exquisite capitalist irrationality. In that situation, the government is turned to by upset people, people who have no job, people who need the output that isn't being produced, people who want the income so they can send their kids to college, all of that makes people turn to the government and say, for heaven's sake, do something. Fix this. Correct this. The private capitalist economy isn't working. Make it work better. At that point, a debate usually begins in the government, with two or three or four political parties, depending on the country, debating what should be done. Right now, in most countries, the policy being pursued by one or another party, or often coalitions of parties, is called austerity. Here's how that policy works. Number one, the argument is made that the biggest single problem the economy faces that the government has to deal with is the debt of the country. The country has borrowed, and it must deal with the debt. That's the argument. Now, before we analyze this, let's remember that the big increase in the debts of most countries in the world today, including the United States, the big dramatic increases happened starting in 2008. Why did they happen? They happened because the capitalist economy hit a stone wall, and suddenly millions of people in months were thrown out of work. Millions of people, as we mentioned earlier in the program, began the process of being thrown out of their home, etc. And the government was called upon by businesses, led by the banks that were in the greatest trouble, to be bailed out. In that demand, guess what? Almost all of the political parties, and certainly here in the United States, the Republicans and the Democrats, fell all over themselves to throw however much money they could think of, hundreds of billions of dollars in stimulus, trillions of dollars in loans and other kinds of funding to the banks. Nobody then worried about the fact that the government was borrowing a lot of the money for this stimulus, that the debts were going through. We had a national economic crisis, and we had to respond. Here we are, 5 years later. Do we have a national crisis? You betcha. to borrow from Sarah Palin. We have a very serious crisis. Only it's now 5.5 years old. Only it has already wrecked many people's lives, interrupted many people's educations, or burdened them with enormous debts that will crunch the rest of these young people's lives, and on and on. The crisis is worse now after 5.5 years than it was even then. For the mass of people, for sure. The banks, having gotten theirs, bailed out. The big corporations, having gotten the benefits of the stimulus and hoarding money in their cash accounts, as we saw earlier, they suddenly want us to be worried about debts. What they didn't worry about before, we should worry about now. And therefore, they demand austerity from the government. The government should deal with debts. And how should it do that? By raising more taxes and cutting spending. Because that way, the government's getting more money out of the people and the economy and won't have to borrow so much. So, for example, taxes are being raised and government spending is being cut in country after country, Britain, the United States, and on and on and on. Here in the United States, payroll tax, huge tax on the middle and lower incomes in America, was raised by over 40% on January 1st, from 4.2% to 6.2%. And starting on March 1st, the sequester went into effect, cutting government spending across the board. Wow. Austerity. What do other people and other political parties think? They don't think austerity is such a good idea. They say, gee, you know, if people are taxed more, they have less to spend. And if they spend less, there's less need of people producing things because people aren't spending to buy them. And that'll make unemployment worse. And likewise, if the government stops spending, since the government is the biggest buyer of goods and services in most economies, and certainly the U.S., then that, too, will cut back demand for goods and services and raise unemployment. So there are a lot of people who say, my goodness, austerity, which deals with debts, is the worst thing to do in an economic depression. And what do they propose? Well, mostly, they propose Keynesian economics. And that's not a complicated idea. Their argument is the government should spend more, not less. The government should tax less, not more. Leave more money in the hands of people to buy goods and services, and let the government buy more goods and services, because that puts people back to work. And don't worry if the government has to borrow to do it. We can take care of the debt problem when we're prosperous again. We shouldn't be doing that in the depths of the downturn. So Paul Krugman and folks like that, they want deficit spending. And the conservatives say, no, 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 austerity. And they go back and forth, and the governments shift, and the policies shift. I don't want to get into the struggle between these two, because I don't think either of them touch the issue. That's not what's going on here. That this is a debate, and that both sides are perfectly happy to have it lop over this way, and we have a little austerity, then we have a little government spending, then we have a little austerity, oscillate back and forth. Liberals and conservatives trading places, musical chairs about who runs the government. Wow. I don't think it matters very much, and I don't think it ever did. Here's what I mean. The government has to act as if it's all excited and trying to solve the problem. Why? Because a mass of people are suffering. They want to see something, and they watch their leaders debate. And they may believe that that's the issue, what they're debating about. But I believe that's a mistake. That while that debate goes on, something is happening that both sides of the debate don't talk about, but are just as happy to see. In economics, let me give you the clear example. While the Republicans and the Democrats, the liberals and the conservatives, the Labor Party and the conservatives, whatever the country story is, while they debate, here's what's going on. The wages of workers are shrinking. The benefits workers are getting are shrinking. The security of their jobs are shrinking. Meanwhile, because so many businesses are not running at 100% or are bankrupt, the costs of a lawyer, the costs of factory office or store space, the costs of raw materials and equipment that you can buy on the secondhand market, they're all going down. Notice, the cost of production is shrinking. And that's true whether we have a little more austerity, a little less. A little more Keynesian spending, a little less. What's really happening, folks, is while the two political sides debate, the reality is we're doing what capitalists want to get out of a crisis. We're making it more and more profitable for them to think about investing all that cash they've accumulated that they haven't wanted to spend. They're basically saying, make it worth our while. Get those wages down. Get those benefits reduced. Get the cost of everything we have to buy less. And when it's cheap enough, we'll come in and we'll produce again. We'll get us out of this crisis when it's profitable to us. We may have been the ones that got you into it, but we're not getting out of it until you make it worthwhile. Until then, we sit. And you can watch Republicans and Democrats debate, but it will make no difference. And in case this seems to you extreme, let me give you some other examples of the same thing. Republicans and Democrats in the United States, for example, debate whether more or less government is good or bad. The Republicans say they want less government. The Democrats say they want a bit more. Meanwhile, as we oscillate between Bush and Obama, Republican and Democrat, conservative and a little more liberal, what is the reality? That the government has become more and more powerful. It surveys all of us. We learned at the National Security Administration, taps our phones, reads our email, does it around the world, for all we know. And the government now has the right to absolve us of all of our civil liberties, to take away our rights under the Patriot Act. The two sides debate, but meanwhile, the reality is the government becomes ever more powerful relative to the citizens. Here's the problem, friends. Nobody wants to talk about the elephant that's in the middle of the room and that makes conversation quite difficult. The real issue. And the real issue is the capitalist corporation. The way we've organized business are in these companies, which have a few major shareholders who own the block of shares. They select the board of directors that makes all the decisions, 15, 20 people at the top. And they make the decisions, for example, to move production from Europe, North America, and Japan to the third world, or what we used to call the third world. Leaves destroyed economies in the old centers and creates unrealistic expectations in the new countries. We've already talked about that. These are the corporations who give a handful of people wild sums of money, which we also talked about today, while the rest of us have a hard time paying for our kids' education. They're the ones who make sure the government bailout comes to them first, and then, after that, they worry about the government's debts. They're the ones who are in the newspaper every day, evading their taxes by using offshore tax havens, by moving their money around the world to make it their profits show up in the country where the taxes are least. Yes, yes. The issue is, who makes the decisions about our production system? That's the key issue. And unless and until we deal with that issue, we're not going to change much of anything. We're going to consider, over and over again, a little more austerity, a little less, a little more government spend. Meanwhile, the underlying reality is the corporations who are creating the economic system we live in are untouched. Their power, their influence, the way they shape what we live with is unquestioned. No debate about that at all. No wondering whether we ought to have a democratic control of our production system rather than the one we have now. I find that extraordinary. And it seems to me that what we see is a political system that specializes in avoiding and evading the central question, not in dealing with it as they were elected to do. Let me turn now to the final section of our program, where I deal with questions, comments that you have sent in, and that I'm pleased to be able to do today. The first one is actually a correction, and I want to thank Darren for pointing this out. In my discussion last week of community colleges and the crunch on their financing and what that has meant in these institutions, which educate more Americans than any other institutions of higher education, community college really are a service for the mass of the American people, I made comments about their inability to solve and to serve the educational needs of the people who go to them. And Darren took me to task, and rightly so, for saying you could interpret what I was arguing as though the fault, in some sense, lay with the community colleges. Granted, they weren't given the finances and the resources to do their job, but they were failing. And his point is, and I agree with him, that we have a much bigger problem with our educational system. He points out that he himself teaches in a community college, and that they have had to struggle with the fact that the young people, or for that matter the older folks, who come to community colleges are woefully unprepared in basic language skills, basic mathematical and arithmetic capability, and that the community colleges are in many cases required to do remedial work to make up for their students what has already been the failure of the public education system before you get to community colleges. One of the ways this economic system we live in does a disservice to all of us is crippling the educational system. Over 500,000 school personnel have been laid off by pinched school districts across America during this crisis. We need more education for the future. We're doing less. And the community colleges are caught in a system, not of their making, doing the best they can with fewer resources and more remediation. It is an impossible burden. The first question I want to deal with is about the Puerto Rican economy. I've been asked to talk a little bit about it, and I've been criticized for not doing it enough, and both of those are well taken. Puerto Rico is an island, as you all know. 3.7 million people is the population. The first thing to know about it is that Puerto Rico for the United States is a little bit like Greece for Europe. The unemployment rate in the United States, 7.5%. The unemployment rate in Puerto Rico, 14%. That's right, double what it is in the United States. So bad are the conditions there that they're losing people again, leaving the island because the economic conditions are so bad, just like people are leaving Greece because the economic conditions and prospects are so poor. Meanwhile, the Puerto Rican government is in a special quandary, again, like Greece. Over the last 10 or 15 years, 20 years, corporations moved to Puerto Rico, often from the mainland of the United States, often to take advantage of the low wages in Puerto Rico. And they promised that the arrival of big capitalist enterprises, particularly in pharmaceuticals, would transform the economy, that Puerto Rico should make all kinds of tax concessions and other benefits, which they did, to bring these corporations that would create jobs and prosperity and all the promises of a capitalism which turn out not to be real, which turn out to fade with the first economic downturn, let alone one as bad as the one we're in. So Puerto Rico's in terrible trouble. And what is the government there about to do with their 2014 budget? They just passed. The answer of the government there is, you guessed it, austerity. They're raising taxes of all kinds because they can't borrow any more money. The debt, you see, is so big a problem. Wow. Here we go again. Two kinds of taxes. A tax on corporations dealing with each other, but the other kind of tax I have to say a word about. This tax is called gambling. Puerto Rico is already allowing all kinds of gambling publicly, casinos of all kinds and so on. But let's remember what gambling is. Gambling is a tax by another name. The overwhelming majority of people who gamble, the overwhelming majority of people who buy lottery tickets particularly, are poor, middle income and poor. And the money is going into the government. Most of what you spend is in the hands of the government, directly or indirectly. So it's a way for the government to get more money by selling you a fantasy. You are going to be rich. Maybe. You know you're not. You know your chances are infinitesimal. But you buy the fantasy, and this way the government can pull money out of you. It's just a tax by another name. So in the middle of 14% unemployment, the government of Puerto Rico is going to tax itself, put less money in the hands of people who buy lottery tickets and go to casinos, less money in the hands of small businesses who have to pay these new taxes. It's going to make their economic situation worse. Takes care of their debt, which the lenders, mostly banks in New York, are concerned with. What a way for a system to work. People say to me, does capitalism solve problems? No, I say. Capitalism multiplies problems. And never more than today. In the time that remains, I wanted to go back to something I had been doing in earlier programs that a number of you have asked me to resume, and to talk to you about functioning, successful worker co-ops, both in the United States and abroad. And I'm going to be doing that more because you've asked me to. The one I want to mention today is called River West Public House Cooperative. Public House is the origin of the term pub. The first three letters of public house is pub. It's basically a drinking establishment. Most famous in England and other places and influenced by the English tradition of pubs on the corner, public houses. This one, River West Public House Cooperative, is a pub, but it's located in the United States, and in particular in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's been going there many years, and it is very successful. And I'm interested in it for two reasons. First, it's a workers' co-op. The workers who do the work of maintaining that business, a successful public house, pub, are organized collectively. They democratically operate that business. Nobody's a supervisor. Everybody is a collective participant in a democratic work process. But I'm particularly interested because it is also a membership corporation. It allows the patrons, for a small amount of money, to become a member of this business, a consuming member, a customer. And together, the members, the customers who are the majority, together with the collective of workers, they call it the workers' collective, they actually call it that, they together run this business. Just imagine. A business not run by a small board of directors selected by the major shareholders. Not at all. A business run by the customers it serves and the workers who make it serve them. Together, the customers, the community of users of the service, and the workers who produce it, together make the decisions. My goodness, what an interesting alternative to capitalist organization. Think about it. Are these people going to close shop and move out? Not likely. Are they going to give a tiny amount of whatever profits they earn to one or two top executives while everybody else is scrambling? Impossible. Are they going to be attentive to the real needs of their customers? You bet, because the customers are part of the decision-making apparatus. All the things capitalism doesn't have, the River West Public House Cooperative in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, has been struggling with, has been experimenting with, and most important, has been successful with. A successful, non-capitalist, workers' Cooperative in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Why aren't we, as a society, taking this opportunity, this moment in our history, when capitalism is showing its weaknesses, its failures, and its inability to deliver the goods to the American people and indeed to the people of all the other countries that endure a capitalist economy. At this time, when the flaws of capitalism are as clear as they have become, is the time when we should be supporting, encouraging, and building worker cooperative enterprises, membership enterprises, just like River West Public House Cooperative in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and the many others like it. What an interesting way to turn a bad economic situation into a new beginning. Instead of bailing out the old capitalist corporations so they keep doing what today's program shows them to have done, how about saying, let's not bail out the old ones, let's use the money instead to support the building of new co-ops, enterprises where the workers will have every interest in making them succeed, where the Federal Reserve pumps new money into the country by giving loans to banks. Here's an alternative. Why don't you give it to co-ops? Why don't you enable co-ops to have the startup money they desperately need to chart a new direction? Let them compete with the capitalist enterprise. Let's make a good thing out of the bad thing of our economy. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. Thank you for joining me, and I look forward to talking with you again next week.
After a while, going to do mine, won't be mine. One of these days, I'm moaning, droning, babe. Try, won't be long.